Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Eat Your Heartland Out with me, your host and tour guide, Capri Cafaro. Our show this hour celebrates agricultural and culinary tourism. The Midwest has a number of options for food lovers and ag adventure seekers. Today, we're going to introduce you to two of the best programs designed for visitors to experience the food and the bounty of the region. And we meet some of the people behind these tourism initiatives. Lindsay Skeen, Executive Director of the Indiana Foodways Alliance, gives us a front row seat to the over 20 culinary trails she helps organize in the Hoosier State. She also introduces us to Ben Morgan, owner of the 1925 Pub House, and Patrick Rice, owner of the Tin Plate. Both of their restaurants participate in the Tenderloin Lovers Trail. But first, I welcome Candy Welsh-Streed, Director of Partnerships for Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area in Iowa, a unique region that highlights the state's agricultural and industrial heritage through a variety of curated locations for tourists to stop, learn, and experience Iowa all for themselves. Candy, thanks for joining us from Iowa. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, this Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area is something that I've heard about for a while and something that I've been really curious about. And so when we had a chance to connect, I was really excited to learn more and then to share the story of Silos and Smokestacks with our listening audience. So first things first, tell us, what is the Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area?
Well, Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area is Iowa's only National Heritage Area, and we are a partner with the National Park Service. There are currently 55 National Heritage Areas in the United States, but we are the only one located in Iowa.
So what does it mean to be a National Heritage Area versus maybe a National Heritage Site?
I like to kind of describe it. A national park unit is owned by the federal government and managed by federal employees, but national heritage areas are managed by a local regional entity. They work in public-private partnerships to preserve their American story or whatever they have contributed to the American experience. So in Pittsburgh, you have Rivers of Steel, and they're preserving the steel industry story. Motor Cities in Detroit is preserving the automobile heritage. Here in Iowa, our story is about American agriculture and how Iowans have influenced American agriculture and continue to today. So we're a unique heritage area in the fact that our story didn't have an end and didn't have a beginning and an end. Our story continues. We sometimes reference it as a living landscape. You can see the story of American agriculture throughout Northeast Iowa.
So you've very well defined what the National Heritage Area is and what it means in Iowa, but there is so much more, beneath the surface. So if we were to go and visit Silos and Smokestacks and this National Heritage Area, what would we find and how would we find it? Because it sounds like it's a pretty expansive region.
The Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area is a 37-county region in northeastern Iowa. So we're about 20,000 square miles. Essentially, the interstate, if people are familiar, Interstate 80 and Interstate 35, we kind of are, the Heritage area kind of comes across those areas and up to the northeastern quadrant of the state. And it started that, and you might go, why not the rest of the state of Iowa? Sometimes you might say politics. You might say that it was an act of congressional act. Congress and legislation that determined our boundaries. It started out as a Waterloo, Iowa effort, which is home of John Deere Tractor.
Which is obviously one of the most iconic brands when it comes to ag equipment and anything else.
And that's the tip of the iceberg, really, when it comes to Iowa, our region's agricultural history and significance, because there were many other producers of agricultural implements like Hartpar, Oliver, White, to name a few. But the Heritage area began from an effort of Waterloo concerned citizens. They were concerned about what happened to their community after the farm crisis. We saw huge declines of employment in ag industry. And so they had no idea that when they started out looking at preserving their community and providing some economic development, they would stumble on to becoming a national heritage area. They quickly realized their relationship between what they did in the industrial hub of Waterloo and what happened around the region of northeastern Iowa when it came to agriculture production.
No, you certainly have, but you know, I it's obviously brought up kind of another question of how do you make that leap from, you know, a group of volunteers trying to deal with kind of a Main Street revitalization, economic development, and all of this to becoming, you know, a national heritage area?
Actually, it was quite the effort. Basically, national heritage areas began there in the 80s. There was the I&M Canal that was created with the National Park Service in outside of Chicago about the I&M Canalway and its role in American development and westward development. And after that, though, you know, national parks, the National Park Service knows they can't preserve all things related to our American history by owning it in federal lands. So that's why they created this new model of national heritage areas. So then what happened is in the National Park Service did a feasibility study, and they determined that the agricultural heritage resources that in northeastern Iowa were nationally significant. And that kind of got the ball rolling and designated this region of northeast Iowa as a region of national significance related to agriculture. What happened here in Iowa, you know, part of it has to do with our land is so fertile. I think we have something like 25% of America's grade eight soil right here in the world's soil. 25 of its top soil is here in Iowa. And so, and we could go on about how that happened. You know, it's this heritage area is this national heritage area around agriculture is here in Iowa because Iowans raised their hands and said, we want to be the keepers of America's agricultural story. And we think we've got the resources to do it. And so, hence, they created this relationship with the National Park Service. And as you say, the rest is history. So important, the story of agriculture, because food affects all of our daily lives.
Of course.
A basic and constant necessity, right? And, you know, these days, in early American history, 98% of our population worked in agriculture. Today, I think it's less than 2%. I'm not sure the exact number right now, but it's many folks are disconnected with where their food comes from. So it makes their work as a national heritage area that much more significant.
There are individual kind of sites and participants that are telling that story of agriculture in the region.
Yes.
How are those participants, locations selected to be part of, you know, this national heritage region? I mean, you're not going to, you know, designate every gas station and, you know, what and fast food chain to be part of it, right? So there's got to be a process that says, you know, this location fits what, you know, the story that we're trying
exactly.
to tell has that historical and cultural significance to be part of it. So what's that process?
Well, that is a big part of my job, is to help identify those sites. There are currently roughly over 100, 110 different sites involved, ranging from vineyards to county historical sites, national historic landmarks, nationally, internationally recognized museums, living history farms, farms themselves, ag businesses. Each of those sites goes through a process, a peer review process, that was established by the sites themselves with the Silos or nonprofit organization. That I work for the Silos and Smokestacks nonprofit organization. I forgot to mention that. That has the responsibility of helping coordinate the efforts of the heritage area. And so we work with the sites to look at, okay, you know, first criteria is where you're located. Are you located within the heritage area boundaries? And then we look at what stories do you tell and what kind of experiences do you offer and how are they presented to the public and creating a positive visitor experience. But we really focus on what makes their site unique and special to the story of American agriculture, but then how was that representative of what happened in the nation when it and how it influenced, you know, in some cases it might have had influences nationally. You know, I always say I work with engineers from Kinsey Manufacturing or John Deere to your grandma that helps manage the County Historical Society, you know, so
right.
and to museums. So anyone that has a keeper of our cultural heritage in Iowa, that is synonymous with agriculture. And so I, you know, it can be any type of site that we can work with, but we really focus on helping them develop their story and create it, help them create new ways for people to engage with it through programs, you know, tours, different types of experiences. So,
can you give me an example?
It's a very satisfying job.
It sounds like a fun job. It definitely sounds like a fun job.
I feel so fortunate to be an Iowan myself and be able to work with Iowa's keepers of our agricultural, our cultural heritage. I always say they're the best people in the world because they care deeply. You know, if there's someone there that in that community that says, you shall not pass, you know, you're not going to tear down this old mill. It has a history and it's important. Let's find a reuse for it and preserve and share it. So that, you know, I'm pretty fortunate that Iowans have, feel a great responsibility to preserving their heritage.
I totally agree. And I do see this in, you know, meeting the folks that I meet through interviewing folks for this program, that I think that is very much a Midwestern characteristic that they're, not to say that that's not possessed by others across the country or the world, but, you know, I think that there is this sense of responsibility to preserve heritage for the next generation and help people understand the context in which, you know, they come from and how that impacts how they're living today. So you have a number of different ag adventures, and kind of like these, they're called tour loops, and I want to touch on those because I think it's a good example of everything that we've been discussing up to this point. You know, helping people tell that story, getting individuals out there to understand and access some of these very important agricultural stories, and understanding where their food comes from. So there are a number of different loops. Why don't you run us through some of them?
I will do that. I just was going to pull that up. A lot of times in Iowa, we do try to organize some of the loops kind of geographically, in rural regions and or off of a metro hub. One of our themes is a river runs through it. Iowa's full of river towns, and you can explore, the history of ice houses, schoolhouses, nature trails. Ag in the metro area is another one here in Waterloo that we do, where you have and that one's in the Des Moines area, but there are ones around along the back roads and finding hidden treasures. The city of Waterloo is the city of 100 smokestacks because of its ag industrial history in Waterloo. And you can explore that through art, through the actual ag industry, or in museums. Some others, the community of Dubuque is near where I grew up. It's one of Iowa's oldest cities. It's a river town on the Mississippi River. And you can experience places like the National Mississippi, easier said than done, the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquariums in Dubuque, who they really do a fantastic job of talking about land conservation, water conservation, and the relationship of transportation on the Mississippi River and agriculture, but also the natural life. So it just goes on and on. I would say that for many folks looking at these tours, some might think of Iowa just as a flyover state, but Iowa is so much more than that. In fact, we have really wonderful, authentic experiences people can have, as well as Iowa's a very affordable place to visit in a lot of ways.
Absolutely, I actually am just looking now at the not a flyover state circuit, there's so much here. The Pioneer Museum, I know that the Heartland Museum, and there's so much. I noticed not on this specific trail, but there's also an African American museum that's part of one of the Iowans in their heritage category.
Yes. The Not a Flyover State, the Adventures one, those are a lot of our smaller museums. And I would encourage people that sometimes those can be the best places to go and the best experiences. And in some cases, those smaller rural communities are run by the local volunteers and they're by appointment only. I would not let that deter you. I would say go for it, because they care about these places so deeply and genuinely are glad you came, and that your tourism dollar really does have an impact in their community. And you can see some authentic ways of life. Agriculture isn't just a business, it's a way of life in our rural communities. And that, that's kind of in my mind when I look at that tour of different places, talks about the history of our country schools as well, because Iowa's country schools helped build a nation. You had asked about Iowans and their heritage, and there's just so many places to intersect that. And Iowans, are modest folks, but they were tinkerers, and they tried to make life easier for themselves on the farm, created what they needed to get things done to do the job. And so you can see that transformation of what that did to Iowa farmers, what it did to help them on the farm. It ended up helping a nation and a world in producing enough food to feed ourselves. And so, that's when you say Iowans and their heritage, that's what I think of. But you also mentioned the African American Museum of Iowa, which is Yeah. I think they're going through some major renovations right now. They just are closing, I think, in August for a little bit while they do some renovations, because they're also along Cedar River, and they suffered some major flooding in areas now a few years back, but they're getting back to some of those, you know, improvements so that doesn't happen to their areas again. And anyway, but the African American Museum has such an important role. It's a very in Iowa, the role of African Americans, their history is not very well known. And so they've been doing some great job, have been doing some great exhibits that help share that story and what innovations that African Americans had, especially like in refrigeration of agriculture. But it's something I didn't know. Also the super soaker. But if you've got kids, you'll know what that is. It's amazing to think about all the different sites that we work with, and there are always more coming. And people are like, aren't they done? And I'm like, no, there's always some new experiencing developing, you know, be it vineyards or farm experiences. People are continuing to preserve and share their experiences. We just got to hold on and keep riding along with it. So,
yeah, well, I mean, I think you've just described exactly why people need to go visit this region, because you end up learning something that, you know, is right under your nose, that is so significant, that you would have never known unless you made the effort. And that, I think, is why it's so important to have a national heritage region like this in Iowa, because, it's not just one thing, one place. It's this collective, and agriculture is so significant to, you know, our nation's story, the Midwest story, and obviously everybody's got to eat. So I'm so glad that we've had a chance to chat. Before I let you go, where can folks learn about Silos and Smokestacks and how they can plan their own adventure?
The fastest way is to go to our website, and it's silosandsmokestacks.org. It is all written out and squished together. And there's an explore tab, and there's a trip planning tool that you can use. You can also order a visitor guide there if you'd like to be able to toss that visitor guide into your glove box. But I also, you know, would encourage people to participate in, an event we have. It's a national event, called it's a photo contest, and, it's an annual photo contest for both amateur and professional photographers, and you can submit your photos now between now and October 31st, but taking photos of what agriculture looks like in your community. And there are many categories and prize money. If I have time, I'd love to tell you that about the Iowa Eats Food and Drink Festival.
Yes,
that's coming
up. I mean, this, go for it.
Awesome. That is something new we're working on, that will happen next year, April 1st, of 2023. It'll be held here in our headquarters, community in Waterloo, Iowa. It's a 1-day celebration of Iowa food and drink. And there will be food and beverage tasting, cooking and product demonstrations, entertainment. But just for us in Northeast Iowa, this kind of thing really hasn't happened at that level. So we're super excited to involve, not only Iowa residents, but visitors from the nation, around the nation.
Well, that's definitely a good tip. I mean, it sounds incredible. I know that there's going to be, you know, authors and demonstrations and chefs and a whole lot of things there that will really engage the public and help them learn even more. So we won't forget April of next year, the first Iowa Eats Food Festival. Just another reason to go visit this region out in Iowa. We really appreciate your time, Candy, and we appreciate you sharing the story of Silos and Smokestacks with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And we hope that you'll come join us at the Iowa Eats event.
I would be honored. I would be honored. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This week on Meat and Three from HRN, we're dissecting the mojito, one ingredient at a time.
Because it's fizzy water and it's different to other waters we've seen, it must cure something.
I actually hadn't heard that Sir Francis Drake story before, but it was so typical it had me rolling my eyes over here.
There was no other substance around where you could get so much booze per buck.
Tune in to Meat and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Eat Your Heartland Out. This hour, we are talking tourism. Our last guest, Candy Wells-Streed, shared highlights of Iowa's Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area, which features a variety of agricultural-related attractions. Now, I welcome our next guests, all from the Hoosier State. Lindsay Skeen is the executive director of the Indiana Foodways Alliance. She's also joined by Ben Morgan, owner of the 1925 Pub House, and Patrick Rice, owner of the Tin Plate. Both of their restaurants participate in the Foodway Alliance's Tenderloin Lovers Trail.
Well, this is a very, very tasty segment that I think is going to make everybody want to get in their cars and get in a plane and go to Indiana. And so first I want to welcome in Lindsay, the executive director of the Indiana Foodways Alliance. Lindsay, thank you for being part of the program today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So introduce us all to the Indiana Foodways Alliance. Who are you and what do you do?
Okay, well, my name is Lindsay Skeen, and I am the executive director of Indiana Foodways Alliance. And we are a not-for-profit membership marketing organization, and we promote locally owned restaurants all throughout the state of Indiana. And we do that through our 21 culinary trails. And so what we do is we promote all those locally owned restaurants. We do not allow franchises in our organization. And really just tagging into that local piece, the mom and pop shops, the restaurant down the road owned by person that you've known forever. So that is who we are. We have 21 different culinary trails. Some of those are, of course, the Tenderloin Lovers Trail, which is popular in Indiana due to the pork tenderloin sandwich. We have the Hoosier Pie Trail, which is very, very popular throughout the Midwest. It is paying homage to the Sugar Cream Pie Trail.
Hoosier Pie is great. I was just going to say Hoosier Pie is great.
Yeah, I don't know if any of you have ever had it. I know Patrick and, of course, Ben have, but it is delicious. They used to call it Desperation Pie, and that is because they would just use what they had on hand during the Depression.
See, you learn a little bit every time, you go on one of these trails. You know, it's not just about eating good food. It's kind of about learning about the culture around you as well, which is what I find really great about this. You noted a number of different trails, and I want to get to the Tenderloin Lovers Trail in a second because we're going to bring in some special guests. But how do you choose these different trails? I mean, like I said, there are how many? 30-something trails? 21. Okay, so there are 21, and I'm looking at some of them here. Chicken, and you have Farm to Table, Here Fishy Fishy, Barbecue, Brews, all kinds of things. So I feel like, you know, anybody, that if, whatever you like, whatever you're looking for, you're going to find them on one of these 21 trails. But how do you select them outside of, you know, obviously, as you mentioned, you're not going to have, you know, franchises on here. It's going to be those mom and pops, those, you know, those establishments that are rooted in these individual communities. But is there anything that goes into it when it comes to being specifically capturing the spirit of Indiana food or culture?
Well, for instance, the Just Cruisin' Trail is very popular. So Indiana has many different drive-ins, drive-ups, and classic restaurants that, you know, date back to the, you know, the 50s. And people really enjoy that in Indiana. They want that nostalgia. And so we have that highlights those specific restaurants all throughout the state. There is a dense population in of those restaurants. I know the Anderson area, which two of our guests are from, have three of those restaurants on that trail. And we love it because people want to tap into that nostalgia. We dating back to, you know, the 1950s and 60s when things were a little bit simpler. So we do promote that. And we have those all throughout the state of those drive-ins and drive-ups and cruise-in type of restaurants.
I know people do love that nostalgia, and I'm sure that that does attract people, not just from Indiana, but from, you know, around the region.
Yes, absolutely. And another trail is the Winner Winner Chicken Dinner Trail, which is a very popular trail on our in our organization as well. And it's tapping into that fried chicken, and in that region in Indiana, whether it's, you know, the northern region and the Amish piece. We have several restaurants that highlight that fried chicken. And I think it taps into something within relating back to, you know, when you're younger, or at least in my case and the generation before me, is that's what you did on Sunday, is you sat down, you had a meal with your family, whether it's out on a restaurant, and fried chicken, believe it or not, was a staple in that. And I know, and Ben and Patrick here today can also talk on that as well, but it taps into that feeling of, community and family, and people tie that in together, enjoying that fried chicken, within those restaurants on the trails.
Well, I got to ask one thing about fried chicken in Indiana just quickly, because we do have a big Amish community as well in northeastern Ohio. So I'm familiar with, you know, the very, you know, juicy chicken that is often, you know, served in the Amish communities. But there's a part of northeastern Ohio outside of Akron, actually, that is very known for its, quote, chicken houses, fried chicken. And they have what they call hot sauce, but frankly, it looks like rice and beans. And so I'm curious, before I go on to pork in a second, but is this something that you see there too? Do they have something called hot sauce that looks like rice and beans? I'm just kidding. Or are we just weird?
No. Well, you're certainly not weird. Everybody has their own unique things that they're known for. However, I have not seen that personally, and I have been to many, many restaurants all throughout Indiana. Not all of the Winner Winner Chicken Dinner Trails are Amish. I know that northern base that we have, I have not seen that up there in the restaurants that are on the trail. For instance, Blue Gate in Shipshawana is heavy populated with the Amish community, and that's what they highlight in that restaurant. So no, I have not seen that. I don't know if Ben and Patrick can talk on that at all, but really what this trail is with the fried chicken is just bringing back that sense of family and what it feels like on a Sunday, and tapping into those emotions.
I love that. And, you know, food is all about emotions and nostalgia, and culture. And, you know, I know that Indiana is a big pork producer. This pork tenderloin is famous enough to have its own trail. And we are lucky to have two guests with us today that are part of the Tenderloin Lovers Trail in Indiana. So I will go ahead and bring you both into the conversation, Ben and Patrick. Ben, let me start with you. If you can just tell us a little bit of background about you and your restaurant, and how you came into the Tenderloin Trail.
Sure. My name is Ben Morgan. I'm the owner of the 1925 Pub House restaurant in Anderson, Indiana. And we've actually just been in business for a couple years, actually. So it was pretty amazing to be on the trail and to be ranked as high as we were, you know, just getting our business going, for sure. Been in the restaurant industry since 1986, so a lot of experience, know a lot of people in the industry, been in operations and such, and decided during the pandemic of all times to open up my own restaurant. So I had a unique opportunity come our way to take on a property that was actually owned by the city of Anderson. It was a restaurant ready to go. It's on a golf course, so it's pretty much destination dining. And, you know, we told the city when we opened that we weren't going to be a hot dog and hamburger joint. We're going to be a destination dining casual restaurant with a pub. And they were all for it. So we opened up in August of 20. And then shortly afterwards, we heard from the Madison County Visitors Bureau and Lindsay with the Indiana Foodways Alliance. They came in, tried us out and said, "Oh, my gosh, your tenderloins are incredible. You're a hidden gem. You should be on our Tenderloin Trail." And that's how we got started with them. Our chef is, we have an executive chef, Kevin Collins, extremely talented. He's been making tenderloins for a long time. So it's not just like a new recipe that just came about in the last couple of years. It's his baby. He gets all the credit for it. We felt like, you know, we build it and they will come, and that's what happened. And there's not too many other restaurants that can actually say that Amelia Earhart ate in the restaurant.
I was just going to ask you about that. I'm glad that you brought that up, because I did see that, and I wanted to, before I bring in Patrick, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the history of this building, and how you have paid homage to that history.
Oh, thank you. So, you know, our name, 1925, you know, as I said, we're on a golf course. So the golf course itself was built in 1925. We're in an older building, so wanted to embrace the age, right? So what better way to do it with that? And our building was built in 1927. We got with the Indiana Historical, the Anderson Historical Society, and met with them. Stephen Jackson's his name. He is a lit legend around here, knows everything about the history of Madison County. And I tell you, he came by with pictures and a bunch of stuff that that happened at this location, at Grandview, you know, almost 100 years ago, including it was a ladies' luncheon. They were opening up an airfield, a new airfield in Anderson, and Amelia Earhart was there, Eddie Rickenbacker, Captain Weir Cook. So there's a lot of dignitaries at this opening. And we actually have a picture in our restaurant of Amelia actually there on property, which is really cool.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
I think that's the great thing about these trails, that you can go, you can connect the dots, you can experience so many different things as you sort of follow that map along under that one umbrella theme. And in this case, you know, we're dealing with pork tenderloin. So we're going to try to take you on a mini tour now to the Tin Palace and Patrick Rice. Patrick, thank you for being here as well. And same kind of questions to you. What is your background? And tell us about the Tin Palace and what brought you to be part of that Tenderloin Trail.
The Tin Plate is the name of the restaurant, and we opened in 2015. Since then, we have come to be known as a good tenderloin spot. Some say better than others, but you know how that goes in Indiana. Everyone's got a tenderloin, and everyone's is the best. So you know how that goes. but we are in a building that's kind of funny. In a building that was built in 1927 as well.
And
there's a lot of history in our area. The reason it's named the Tin Plate is because of the original tin plate factory in the United States was in Elwood, Indiana, opened in 1892. And my building was actually built as a bar and a general store and a rooming house to service the men and women that worked at the Tin Plate. So that was, you know, a little history on our side. Our tenderloin is very unique, and it's one of a kind, and we really, really, really like to get them out there. So,
you have an interesting story about how you kind of fell into your tenderloin recipe or specialty. You want to share that?
Sure. The Saturday before we opened, we had friends and family night at the restaurant. I was real nervous. I hadn't really worked a whole lot on the tenderloin, but, you know, I threw a tenderloin together that night, and the comment cards from my friends and family came back, and every single person that ate a tenderloin said, "This is downright horrible. You need to just scrap it. Don't even put it on the menu." And I was like, well, I've got to have a tenderloin. I'm in Indiana. So Monday morning, we're opening at 11 o'clock, and it's like 9:30. I'm in the kitchen, and I've got a bowl prepared, and I threw a couple of ingredients in there, and I got called away to go to the cash register because all of a sudden the cash register didn't want to power up. So when I was dealing with the cash register and all of that, my father, who is my partner in this venture, he went in there, seen that I'd had something in the bowl. He breaded a tenderloin and fried it and brought it out and said, "Wow, you did great on this breading. This is amazing." And I was like, "Dad, it's not done. I've got this to go in there." And he's like, "Here, just try it." And I tried it, and I was like, "Wow, you're right." And that's been our tenderloin. It was basically a mistake that turned into our tenderloin.
That's awesome. Well, sometimes the most simple is actually the best, and it sounds like that was definitely the case.
Definitely.
With yours. And how long, Patrick, have you and the Tin Plate been participating in the trail?
Lindsay came to us, I believe, in 2015, right? A couple months maybe after we opened, and her and Maureen from the Madison County Visitors Bureau, they both came in and they ate, and we met, and we had a good rapport, and it wasn't too long after that I was on the trail.
Love it. So you both obviously are part of this trail. You're both in Anderson, as far as I understand. But I want to ask, I guess ubiquitous as the, pork tenderloin is in Indiana, you know, everybody has, I guess, maybe a little bit of their own twist. I'm going to ask you first, Ben, how do you serve your tenderloin? Is it a sandwich? Is it a platter? Excuse my naivete on the pork tenderloin. So if I'm asking questions that sound absolutely moronic, this is a learning opportunity for both me and the audience.
No problem. Well, it's going to be served most of the time as a sandwich, right? That's why everybody in Indiana is used to it, and they're going to judge you on having that best sandwich because it's all about the ingredients as well. So what kind of pork and, how are you pounding it out thin or do you have a thicker cut? How's the breading on it? The breading profile, does the bun smash well on the tenderloin? Do you have a crisp, lettuce and onion and tomato and right mustard, everything else to go along with it? I mean, everybody has the best, just like Patrick said. I mean, it's a serious deal around here for sure. It's one of those things in Indiana you take very seriously. So when you have people that come to you and say, "Hey, listen," and recognize you as having one of the top, sandwiches around, you know, we all get compliments, and Patrick's got a great reputation. I've been to his restaurant numerous times.
Thank you, Ben.
You do a great job there. And, you know, and that's one thing that we want to do is like, listen, if we're going to have a tenderloin, we're going to do it right. And Chef's recipe, we felt like a thicker, it's a little thicker. It's not the pounded out version. It's a little thicker, the way we like it, so people can bite into it. It has a great bite, and our customers and the folks that have discovered us seem to appreciate that. And it's having that right bun. And we actually went through many different buns just to find out which one fits well, which one's going to hold and serve as a great carrier for the tenderloin. That was our main goal right when we started.
You bring up a good point about the ingredients, which are obviously the key to any, you know, good final product is the ingredients you put into it. Do you use, all or predominantly locally sourced ingredients for your tenderloin as far as from Indiana?
Yeah. The pork is from here. So the pork's from Indiana, for sure. The ingredients that we get, I mean, where we can, you know, some of the seasonings and such, I mean, some of that you can't control, but the pork definitely is important for us to have. It's from Indiana. So, that's the most important piece that we see. And then also, you know, whatever you can get with the lettuce and tomato or whatever else that goes along with it, when it's in season to get it locally, if possible. Yeah.
Sure. Of course. Patrick, what about you and your tenderloin? We heard about the breading, which, you know, I think we could all agree is incredibly important to all of this. But
yes.
How do you put all of this together? Is it a sandwich for you too?
We have several different ways we do the tenderloin. We have, of course, the sandwich, which is the most popular. We sell about anywhere from 18 to 20,000 sandwiches a year.
Wow.
Which is quite, it equates to, I believe, about 6 tons of pork. We also serve what's called a tenderloin Manhattan. It's a tenderloin that is served over your choice of bread, mashed potatoes, tenderloin, and then our roast beef Manhattan gravy over the top, which is all in all, it's its own thing as well, because I'm actually in Elwood, which is a little outside of Anderson, and the big dog in Elwood is Red Gold Tomato products, the big factories here. So when we made our Manhattan, we made it with their tomato product. So it's a red gravy Manhattan, and it goes over the whole tenderloin. We have that. We also do a country gravy tenderloin with a white pepper gravy over the top. And then we have a tenderloin salad as well, where we take it lets you, you know, splurge and get tenderloin, but still kind of be healthy in the same realm. So, you know, it's a half a tenderloin. It's fried, it's cut up into strips, and it's, you know, put over the salad, and you eat it with your salad. We do that. And, of course, we have our grilled tenderloin as well for folks that don't like the breading.
Wow. You guys definitely have it absolutely covered when it comes to tenderloin. And do you also source your pork from Indiana?
Yes, as a matter of fact, a very good friend of mine owns a hog farm just outside of town, where he has at any given time 6,000 to 8,000 hogs.
Oh, wow.
He sells specifically to a producer up in Delphi, Indiana, and I get my meat through a company through them. So I basically, my meat is coming from just right outside of town here.
That's great. I mean, that's literally farm to table for sure.
Yes, it truly is. that is truly farm to table.
Yes. Lindsay's met this guy, this farmer as well. So, she knows how cool of an operation it is.
is that Mr. Jarrett?
Yeah. His name is Rick Jarrett.
Yeah. Rick Jarrett. Yeah.
Well, Lindsay, since you're in the conversation, do you have anything to add to this about the Tenderloin Trail or any of the other sort of back end things like the sourcing of the pork or anything of that nature?
We do have actually quite a few. I believe we have 74 stops throughout Indiana on the Tenderloin Lovers Trail. We're up to 74 now.
Wow.
Each of our restaurants go through an assessment process. I do want to say that. And so that is our stamp of approval. Indiana Foodways Alliance, you are now a member, and that's our stamp of approval. So we go in as they both have mentioned, we meet with the owner, we talk about what we do and how we market and what they would expect, but it's learning the story from them, from the owner who, you know, have put their blood, sweat, and tears into their restaurant and, you know, some all of their life savings and to do what they love to do and to serve the community. And so that is my job as the executive director of Indiana Foodways Alliance is telling that story and getting that out there. I think it's very fascinating because with the Tenderloin Lovers Trail, you know, that's the fun thing about it is that everyone has their own unique taste for it or style or however they like it prepared. I know Ben does it one way. Patrick does it another. And everyone who goes on that Tenderloin Lovers Trail and experiences those restaurants, they come out with their favorite or their top five. And believe me, it is a conversation in Indiana.
I bet.
I know it is. You bring it up with friends, family, fellow foodies. They all have an opinion. They all know what they like. And it may be different that, you know, they may like the thinner version at one restaurant, but they like the thicker, more generous portion at another restaurant. So I think that's the joy of the Tenderloin Lovers Trail is that there's something for everyone and a style as, you know, as long as you like that pork and how it's prepared, however you like it prepared, like Patrick was saying, they serve it several different ways. You know, there's just something for everyone. And that's the joy of the culinary trails is you find what food you love, what represents Indiana and you go on the trails, you partake in it and get your bellies full and experience Indiana all in the same, at the same time.
Well, this I think is a great place to end our conversation because you're absolutely right. This is a choose your own adventure, get your belly full, and, you know, learn and explore, you know, and discover all in the process. Lindsay, I want to thank you. And I want to thank you for bringing together Ben and Patrick to share their stories on the Tenderloin Trail. Thank you, everyone, for being on the show today.
Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bottoma.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.